Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Clint Smith grew up in New Orleans until his family had to relocate to Houston in Hurricane Katrina. He has grown to become one of America's most powerful young voices, especially when it comes to the value of Black lives. He's a former Poetry Slam champion, and his two TED Talks have a combined audience of more than 7 million views. He now teaches writing and literature to prisoners in Washington, D.C. And he's also working on a book called How the Word is Passed. It's about American historical sites and how they reckon with, or don't reckon with, our history with slavery. Here's our conversation. Clint Smith, I think you would agree to start with a poem for us. Feel free to do that. And if you want to talk at all about how it came to you or what it's about, feel free to do that too.
Yeah, so this poem is the title poem of my 2016 collection, Counting Descent. And it's really thinking about the sort of different lineages that shape who we are and who we become, both in a macro sense and a micro sense. So what does it mean for me to be a Black man? What does it mean to be an American? What does it mean to be from Louisiana? What does it mean to be a New Orleanian? And then on a sort of more micro sense, like, what does it mean to be my father's son? What does it mean to be my mother's son? What does it mean to be a brother, a sibling, a husband, a father, a grandson? How do all of those things shape the way that I move through the world? And how does this sort of intersection and entanglement of those two, of both the macro and the micro lineages, shape who I am and how I think about the world? So this is the title poem of the book, Counting Descent. My grandfather is a quarter century older than his right to vote and two decades younger than the president who signed the paper that made it so. He married my grandmother when they were 4 years younger than I am now and were twice as sure about each other as I've ever been about most things. They had six children separated by 9 years, three cities, and one Mason-Dixon line. There were twice as many boys as girls, but half as many bedrooms as children, which most days didn't matter because poor ain't poor unless you name it so. And kids prefer playing to counting, so there was never much time to wallow in anything but laughter. My mother was the third oldest, or the fourth youngest, depending on who you ask. She was born on a federal holiday, which my grandmother was thankful for, said the good Lord only got one day off when he built the world, so one day is all she needed to. Mom says Pop was persistent, wouldn't give up when he asked if he could take her down the street to get some coffee, which back then cost $2 less than it does now. Mom is trying to stop drinking coffee, but she still loves Pops. They've been married for 31 years and have three kids who were 6 years and 1,517 miles apart. My birth took 12 hours and 43 minutes, which is probably because my head is five times too big. Mom said that my head was too big because I needed enough room to read all the books in the library, which seemed like infinity, even though I didn't really know what infinity meant. But I heard my teacher say it once when she talked about the universe, and books felt like the universe to me. I was pretty good at math, too, until about fifth grade when they started putting numbers and letters together, which didn't make much sense. My brother is 70 months younger than me, but is taller and knows more about numbers, so it doesn't always feel like this is true. My sister is 24 years of loyal and 8 years of best friend. I am the oldest of three, but maybe the most naive. I still believe that we can build this world into something new, someplace where I can live past 25 and it's not a cause for celebration, because these days I celebrate every breath, tried to start counting them so I wouldn't take each one for granted. I wish I could give my breath to the boys who've had theirs taken, but I've stopped counting because it feels like there are too many boys and not enough breath to go around.
Thank you, Clint. I know that you've been writing and speaking for years about these issues that sort of fall under the umbrella of Black Lives Matter. And now it feels like people in this country and around the world are more than ever engaging with those ideas and those issues. I know you're also working on a book about how we look at historical sites and monuments and things in this country and how we may be looking again
at what those sites are saying to us and what they really ought to be saying to us. I guess what I'm wondering is, do you feel like all this work you've done and this sort of life you built for yourself was sort of building to this moment?
In some ways. I mean, I think that, you know, I certainly have spent the past several years and the majority of my adult life thinking about issues of inequality, thinking about issues specifically of racial inequality and the various manifestations of that and the history that has shaped that, right? Because I think that's often the part of this conversation that's missing, is that we have these national moments of reckoning in which we are asked to think more critically about race and racism and the manifestations of those things in our communities, in our homes, in our workplaces, and in our country. But we don't often do the work of interrogating the sort of larger historical phenomena that have shaped what the contemporary landscape of inequality looks like. And so, you know, I recently graduated from a doctoral program and got my PhD, where I thought about both sort of public history and the larger relationship between education and incarceration, and all of the sort of adjacent parts of our social infrastructure that play a role in, and again, shaping what inequality in this country looks like. And so yeah, in some ways, you know, now the country is engaging in a conversation that I've been, you know, sitting in the library, in the basement of the library, thinking about for many years. But and I think that is a good thing. And I think what is important now is that conversation remains complex, that it remains nuanced, and that it engages with the more difficult aspects of that conversation and of our history without simply allowing Black Lives Matter statements, or without Black Lives Matter signs, or even the tearing down of monuments and the celebration of Juneteenth, or the singing of the Black National Anthem, and all of these things I've been thinking about and in conversation with folks about how those symbols are important. Like, those symbols matter. Like, Juneteenth is a holiday that should be celebrated across this country because it represents an inflection point in this country when our country was moving away from the worst of itself toward the aspiration, at least, of something better. You know, the Black National Anthem is something that has been, Lift Every Voice and Sing is something that has been sung in churches and community events everywhere, you know, that I've been my entire life. And it is one of the most beautiful and important songs in my life. And I think should be a fixture in this country. And the Confederate monuments, you know, these are statues of men who fought a war predicated on maintaining and expanding the institution of slavery, and they should come down. But all of those symbols are important, but they should not, those symbols do not come at the expense of or in lieu of real meaningful policy change. And so, you know, if you take down a statue of Robert E. Lee in your neighborhood, but that neighborhood maintains racial or racist exclusionary zoning policies, then that's not actually the work. You know, if you're singing Lift Every Voice and Sing before the next NFL game, but then, you know, you go back and actively oppose the integration of impoverished students or Black and brown students into your child school, that's also not the work. And so all of these things are both, and they act in tandem. And I think we're in a moment in which we're having a conversation around these issues in a way that we certainly have never had in my own lifetime.
And do you feel like there is some movement toward actual policy changes there? Or are you feeling like gestures so far, like you talked about Lift Every Voice and Sing at the NFL games, does that feel hollow to you at all? Or does that feel like real progress?
It's hard. You know, if the NFL says we are going to play Lift Every Voice and Sing at the beginning of week one, and that is the extent of their engagement or reckoning with these issues, you know, if they don't formally apologize to Colin Kaepernick for institutionally misrepresenting what he did and what he stood for and who he was arguing about, and the point he was trying to make, and blackballing him from the league, you know, if they don't actively wrestle with the fact that so many of their players are coming from communities that are deeply impoverished, and what is their commitment, you know, since those players are the people who are providing the economic foundation of the of the league, what is your commitment to the communities from which your players are coming? And so, you know, what is your relationship to sponsors whose work actively represents, you know, harm and damage to so many of the communities where your players are coming from and the cities where you're positioned? The list goes on and on. But, you know, all that's to say, Lift Every Voice and Sing is a great and important song, as I said. And I actually have no issue with more spaces celebrating that song and singing that song. But if it is done to assuage, or if it is done to somehow put a Band-Aid over what is a much larger issue and a much sort of larger illness, both in the institution of the NFL and as our society, then that is a problem. And, you know, so again, I think that symbols are important, and symbols, what they do is symbols and symbolism and gestures, they shape narratives, and different narratives shape different types of policy. And that's, you know, the success of the Lost Cause from the Confederacy is that they created a narrative using statues and using textbooks and using songs and using literature to create a different narrative about the Civil War that then sort of infiltrated every facet of our sort of social infrastructure and the policy that came out of that.
It seems like the death of George Floyd was this huge tipping point, not just for the actual event of a human being's death, but it also seems to me to have had this huge symbolic value, that as you looked at that, or saw the images or heard about it or whatever, that stood for something that was such a larger thing. I have not been able to bring myself to watch the whole video. And I saw an interview with you from not too long ago where you said you had not watched it either. I don't know if that's changed. Part of me feels like I'd sort of owe it to the moment to see it for what it is, and it's full despair or whatever. But part of me also says, I don't need to. I know what it means. How are you processing that?
So I still haven't watched the video. What are we sort of, certainly more than a month, several weeks away from the incident itself. I don't have a strong opinion about whether or not somebody should or should not watch the video. I don't think anyone has a, and certainly not Black people, I don't think have a responsibility to watch it. I mean, it is not showing us anything that has not existed in Black communities for a long time, long before camera phones existed to capture it. And I do think it's important to wrestle with the way that our society consumes the death of Black people in ways that we simply don't consume of other races and other people. Like, it's difficult to imagine that we would be watching white people killed in the same way that we are. And so I think there's a tension there, both, and I've said this before, but the tension is that these videos are in some ways necessary because they are the sort of catalyst to the outrage, the rightful outrage that we find ourselves in. And without that camera phone video, what has happened over the past several weeks in this country likely would not have happened. It's unfortunate that it takes a video, but we all know that, like, and we've seen on multiple occasions, certainly over the past several weeks, that, you know, what the police report that initially came out of what happened in Minneapolis completely misrepresented what had happened to George Floyd. And if there was nothing, no counter evidence, then that is the sort of primary narrative that would have been shaped around this man's death. And so the video is valuable, but I also wonder, it's not as if at this point people don't know what police are doing to Black people. I mean, we see it in a myriad of forms, and we have seen it over the past several years. And so, you know, that's a long way of saying I've not watched the video. It is not as a result of a deep, you know, political or ideological decision. I think it just there's only so much I can consume visually, given my own emotional bandwidth of Black people being killed. And so, you know, I've read enough about it. I know everything that happened, but sort of subjecting myself to watching the video, you know, maybe I will one day. It's not a sort of never will situation, but at this point I still haven't, and I don't know that there would be any additional value in me doing so.
I know you've done a lot of teaching in prison, and I wonder whether people who are incarcerated are seeing this any differently, or have any opinions that maybe those of us who are not incarcerated wouldn't have thought about in sort of processing these moments as well.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, you know, so I've been teaching in prisons the past 6 or 7 years or so. And unfortunately, I haven't been able to go inside of the jail recently. So I taught in Massachusetts state prisons for several years when I lived in Cambridge. And my family, we live in outside of Washington, D.C. right now. And I teach at D.C. jail. And I haven't been in the jail since January, maybe. Just given because of how quickly and how easily COVID spreads inside prisons, it is not a safe place to be for volunteers. It's not a safe place to be for visitors. It's not a safe place to be for the people who are incarcerated there, you know, or the people who work there. And so I've unfortunately not been able to have conversations with folks on the inside about how they're experiencing this moment. I mean, I know from, you know, the things that I read and the extensive reporting and research that has been done on how coronavirus has impacted people who are incarcerated, that has had a profound impact on their lives, that has had a profound impact on what every day looks like for them. Because so much, I think people don't fully appreciate the extent to which prison programs and sort of educational programs and the opportunity to go to the prison library, the opportunity to be just in some semblance of community with other folks is central to people's desire to simply wake up in the morning. And we are now in a scenario because of the pandemic in which incarcerated people are in many prisons forced to stay inside of their cells almost the entirety of the day, in which they are given little protection from the virus itself, in which they are not able to, they're not able to have visits from family members. When we know that like maintaining social connections with family members specifically through the physical visits is one of the most effective ways to reduce recidivism and ensure that people have something to go back to when they are ultimately released from prison, which is what 95% of people are. And so what I feel is a sense of despair for the men and women and people inside of prisons and jails right now, because prison is an inherently violent place, and it's always difficult to be there. But I think it's especially difficult to be there now because the very thing that gives you a sense of hope, the very thing, you know, whether it's looking forward to a visit from your son, looking forward to a visit from your grandmother, looking forward to a visit from your husband or your wife, those things that people spend so many days and weeks and even months looking forward to are no longer possible. So from the COVID space, it's incredibly difficult and an incredibly sad situation. From the perspective of racial reckoning, you know, something I always tell folks is that there have been a lot of these anti-racism books, you know, book lists going around, and people saying like, what can I read or what can I learn to help me more fully understand how our country has arrived at this moment, and what are the various ways that racism has come to exist in systems, invisibly in systems that we often take for granted or don't fully account for. And I always remember part of why I teach in prisons is because I remember the moments in which I learned that the reason that the world looks the way that it does, the reason this country looks the way that it does, is not because of people in certain communities or sort of dispositions that they have or genetic or biological differences that they have, but it is the result of things that have been done to those communities generation after generation after generation. And I think that I remember when I first started reading books about housing segregation and first started reading books about the exclusionary policies of the New Deal and first started reading books about the history of housing covenants and the history of school efforts to push back school integration. I mean, the list goes on and on. It just helped give language and texture to what I was seeing around me. And it sort of stripped me of a sense of paralysis that I was feeling. And I think that exists in even more so for incarcerated folks, because, you know, when you are incarcerated and somebody hands you the new Jim Crow, or somebody hands you the color of law, or somebody hands you Reconstruction, or somebody hands you, you know, a book that helps explain the reason why the community you grew up in was plagued with violence, was saturated with poverty, had schools that didn't have enough books, or had overcrowded classrooms, or all of these things that shape someone's trajectory into the criminal legal system. It helps to remind that person that it was not simply their fault. And that's not to say that free will doesn't exist, people, personal responsibility and agency don't exist, but it is to say that it is so important to account for the context from which a person is coming and the context of their lives that shape the trajectory of their lives in order to understand how people become entangled in the criminal legal system in the first place. And I think that collectively as a country, I find that we are having that conversation again in a way that I've not seen before. And I guess the question now is the extent to which, like how long that lasts. And if it can move beyond, you know, your reading list, and if it can move beyond the sign in your yard toward policies that will make people's material lives significantly better.
When we come back, Clint Smith talks about trying to process our current moment as a poet and whether that's even possible when you have two young kids at home. That and more ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
I'd like to take just a moment here to remind you of the remarkable work my colleagues at WFAE have done in one of the most trying times I can remember as a journalist. From Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins, to our daily newscasts and features, to our podcasts and stories on the web, our staff has worked long and hard to bring you news about the coronavirus, and more recently, the protests locally and globally after the death of George Floyd. You can help us keep that work going with your donations. Just go to WFAE.org and hit the red donate button at the top. Thank you so much for all your support. Now, back to our conversation with Clint Smith.
I know that one of the important moments of your life as a young person was Hurricane Katrina and having to leave New Orleans because of that. I wonder, I don't want to stretch the symbolism too much. We've been talking about symbols a lot. But I do wonder if anything about our current sort of upheaval, all the things going on in our country right now, if anything about that reminds you of that time of Katrina.
That's interesting. I've been asked that question before. I mean, I was 17 years old when Hurricane Katrina came. I was a senior in high school. And it was an incredibly unsettling time in my life. You know, our home was destroyed, was under, you know, 8 feet of water. I didn't return back to the school that I was planning on graduating from. I never myself moved back to New Orleans. My family ultimately moved back. But I went to college and then have lived in other places for the rest of my life since then. So it was a sort of discombobulating experience. I struggle to make a sort of parallel between Hurricane Katrina and this moment, other than the fact that Hurricane Katrina disproportionately impacted the most vulnerable communities, which is certainly what is happening with COVID-19, that Hurricane Katrina sort of unearthed and unveiled some of the worst, the deepest holes in our society's promise to its most vulnerable citizens. And that it is difficult to, when you are in a moment, like we are still very much in some ways, the beginning of this pandemic. And I think that when you are in the moment, when you are in the midst of something happening, it is difficult to understand and fully know the implications that that is going to have long term, both for places, for people, for institutions. And so, you know, I am still, I think in some ways I am, you know, I'm 31 years old now. Hurricane Katrina happened when I was 17. We're coming up on the 15th anniversary. I am only beginning to wrestle with a lot of the sort of what for a long time was kind of silent trauma that I think I sort of suppressed from Hurricane Katrina, and how disjointed or how fractured my life became in that moment. And to be clear, like I had our home was destroyed, but like I had a home to go to. We stayed with relatives in Houston. I was in a position that was far better off than thousands and thousands of people, you know, people who were in the Astrodome, the Superdome, and the convention center, and places, you know, that and whose lives were uprooted in a way that was fundamentally different from mine. But even in my own case, I think the long-term impact of that moment still manifests itself in ways that I'm still learning. And so what I think a lot about is, you know, I hope that we get a vaccine, you know, early 2021 or whenever they're saying it's supposed to come. And I hope we reach herd immunity, and I hope society can go back to, we'll never go back to normal, but, you know, some semblance of functioning life. But I also am deeply concerned about the emotional trauma, the psychological trauma, the academic implications, the economic implications that this pandemic is going to have for years, if not generations. And so that's what I'm thinking about right now. You know, right now everybody's just trying to stay safe. We're trying to make sure people aren't evicted from their homes. We're trying to make sure people have enough food to eat. But this, you know, this is a once in a century thing that's happening. And in some ways, one, you know, something that our country has never experienced in this specific way. And I am worried about what it means for, again, the most vulnerable people here as we even move out of it in the years and decades that follow.
I wonder how this has affected your creativity. You know, I remember years ago seeing the writer Calvin Trillin wrote for, I think it was the Nation magazine. He would write a poem for every issue, and he called himself a deadline poet. And it's struck me that poetry is not normally a deadline sort of art. But I'm wondering if you have felt urges to write poetry or any other sort of thing during all this, or whether the moment is so overwhelming that it makes it hard to do that.
Oh, man. You know, I have a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old who are...
That's a whole other issue, right?
And they are the light of my life. They are the best, most joyous thing that has ever happened to me. They are also toddlers who require your constant attention. And so my wife and I, for the past 4 months, have been the sole caregivers of our kids. You know, my mom used to come up a lot to help for weeks at a time, or we would go, you know, we'd have babysitters, or we had a nanny, or we, you know, we had daycare, and none of that exists in the same way. And yet, you know, my wife is still working full time. I tried to finish my dissertation at the beginning of the lockdown. I had to defend my dissertation. And now I'm trying to finish a book. that's coming out next year. And so, you know, we are, my creativity is, I think having kids already disabused me of the idea that, you know, my writing would be done like with a warm cup of tea, a candle, some incense with the sunlight from the morning sort of bathing me in its rays. You know, you have a kid and you're quickly disabused of that idea. You know, I write a lot during nap time. I write a lot during Sesame Street. I write a lot when my kids fall asleep in the stroller. When we are going on our walks, I'll park the stroller and I'll write in the notes section of my iPhone. And even before COVID, you know, I was writing in the DMV, in the parking lot of CVS, in the, you know, in the car when the kids fell asleep in the car seat. So, you know, for a while I've been operating under a sort of write however long you can, whenever you can. And creativity is not, it's not this idea that like I have to wait for the right moment, or I have to write at a certain time, or the conditions have to be perfect. It's because if that were the case, I'd never write.
This book you're writing, How the Word Is Passed, how did that come about?
So How the Word Is Passed is a book that in which I go to different historical sites throughout the country and sort of explore how they reckon with, or in many cases fail to reckon with, their relationship to the history of slavery. And so it initially emerged from, you know, in 2015, after Dylann Roof killed 9 people in that Charleston church. There was a sort of moment of national reckoning similar to the one that we're in now, although I think this is a sort of more amplified version of that. You know, the South Carolina decided to pull the Confederate flag down from the Capitol. And in New Orleans, where I'm from, Mitch Landrieu, who was the mayor at the time, decided he was going to take down some statues that were tied to the Confederacy and sort of the general sentiment of white supremacy. And the statues eventually came down in 2017. And I think I became really interested in the sort of Confederate iconography of my own childhood and thinking about how there were so many. I mean, in New Orleans, at this point, there were over 100 schools, buildings, statues, street names named after Confederate soldiers, and named after people who owned slaves. And I was thinking about how, you know, Robert E. Lee Boulevard was the street I drove down every day on the way to school, how P.G.T. Beauregard was a statue of this Confederate general that I walked past every time I went to the park. How Jefferson Davis Highway was the, you know, how I got to the grocery store. And I knew so all of these names of Confederates were so emblazoned and around the city. And I knew so little about the places that New Orleans existed in New Orleans that were tied to the history of slavery itself and enslaved people. And so I became really interested in how places told the story of enslavement and what kind of story they were telling. And so I go to the Blandford Cemetery, which is the largest Confederate cemetery in the country, and went there for the Sons of Confederate Veterans Memorial Day celebration. I go to Monticello Plantation and think about what it means for this place to wrestle with how it communicates that Jefferson was both the person who drafted the Declaration of Independence and also that he was the person who owned over 600 people, right? That he was someone who was the, you know, president of the United States, and he was also someone who enslaved 4 of his own children and wrote, you know, very disparagingly about Black people in his book, Notes on the State of Virginia. And how do you as an institution communicate both of those things and hold both of those truths that once that Jefferson was a brilliant man and that he was also deeply racist? I go to Angola Prison and think about what it means for Angola as an institution to be this 18,000 acre piece of land that is on top of former plantations, and that 80% of its occupants, 70 to 80% of its occupants at any given time are Black men. And I think about if you were to go to Germany, and you had a prison, the largest maximum security prison in Germany, as Angola is the largest maximum security prison in Louisiana. If you had the largest maximum security prison in Germany, and it was on top of a former concentration camp, and 70 to 80% of its occupants were Jewish, it would be a global emblem of anti-Semitism. It would be an affront to our moral sensibilities. It would be unacceptable, and it should be. It would be disgusting. But what is it about the fact that in the United States, the largest prison, maximum security prison in the country, is on top of a foreign plantation, and it's something that is acknowledged, but not something that is found to be deeply offensive to the majority of this country? And what are the ways that white supremacy both enacts violence, but also numbs us to certain types of violences that should otherwise be wildly unacceptable?
Obviously, you may have to be doing some revisions these days, because a lot of this stuff is sort of changing in real time. You know, monuments are coming down, names are being changed, streets names are being changed. Are you surprised that all this is happening this fast? Or maybe does it not feel this fast to you? Or is it kind of inevitable?
Nothing is inevitable. So it certainly is not inevitable. I think it can feel fast to many people because they are thinking about it for the first time. What's also true, and what I try to communicate in the book, is that there are people, activists, public historians, institutions, that have been talking about this and advocating for a fundamental reimagining of how we tell the story of America, how we tell the story of slavery, how we tell the story of Black oppression in this country, who've been doing this work for generations. And so what is true is that, you know, the statues, for example, in 2017 in New Orleans didn't just come down just because of Dylann Roof and Mitch Landrieu. They came down because Black activists in Louisiana and in New Orleans had been advocating for this and pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing for generations. And then something happens in society that creates a moment that allows for that pushing to move through a doorway in a different way than it otherwise would be able to, but in ways that are only possible because of the multi-generational work that has happened before. So what we're seeing now, whether it's the conversation about dismantling the police, prison abolition, taking down the statues, just the fundamental re-engagement and reimagining again of like these institutions that people have accepted as normal for so long, or inevitable inherent fixtures to our society, people for generations have been pushing and saying that like these systems are illegitimate, these systems are wrong, these systems are harmful, these statues are harmful, whatever the case may be. And now we are in a moment because of George Floyd's death, as well as the sort of constellation of deaths of Black people surrounding his, that something has opened up, you know, a doorway has opened up that had otherwise not been opened before. And I think that this is in many ways, certainly not the end, but is a culmination of the work that so many people have put in for so long.
There are a lot of facets of Clint Smith's life. We didn't get into it all. He's a former college soccer player at Davidson and a huge fan of Arsenal in the English Premier League. He posted a Twitter question the other day asking everybody's favorite Motown song. Like all of us, he contains multitudes, and all those parts of him matter. But right now, in this moment, what matters in the public arena is how we think and speak about being Black in America. In essence, why Black lives matter. That's what so many people are still missing, when by reflex they reply that all lives matter. Sure they do. But not all lives are in the same jeopardy right now. Not all lives are on the cusp of such change right now. Not all lives belong in the front of our minds and hearts right now. Clint Smith's work reminds us to reinspect the past and to hope for a better future. But mostly, his work lives in the present tense. Let's deal with what matters most now. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte.
Our audience engagement manager is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app or wherever else you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guests. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Additional support is provided by the Knight Foundation.